Hello, I'm Richard Hurley, the BMJ's Features and Debates Editor. Next week's Maudsley debate, to be held on Wednesday the 22nd of November at King's College London, asks whether fundamental reform to the UK Mental Health Act is needed to reduce discrimination and unnecessary detention. And two of the speakers have contributed an article to the BMJ, and they're joining me by phone now. George Schmuckle is Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry and Society at King's College London, and he thinks that the Mental Health Act has had its day. And Scott Weich is Professor of Mental Health at the University of Sheffield, and he is not so sure. George, for the benefit of all of our readers worldwide, might you briefly explain what the Mental Health Act is and how many people it affects?
The Mental Health Act covers a number of areas, but the most important from our point of view for this discussion is the criteria for admitting people to hospital and treating them against their will. And there it spells out in some detail the criteria, which I can go into if you like, which I have my concerns about. The number of people who have been admitted recently, I think for the last year, I think it was over 60,000 people admitted on an order. And I believe that that is about a 50% increase over the last decade. So it involves increasing numbers of people, which has caused a lot of concern.
And Scott, this debate is timely, isn't it? You mentioned in your article that there's pressure from the United Nations. Why is there this interest in the Mental Health Act now?
Well, I think there's a number of things going on at the moment. As George correctly states, there's real concern about the number of people that are detained every year. More than 60,000 people last year and this big increase year on year that we see. I think there's also, an issue around real challenges around delivering high quality service outcomes and patient experience. And I think there can be little doubt that actually we're not doing very well at the moment in mental health services. So there's real concern that, patients aren't getting as well as they might, and in some areas that suicide rates are going up. And then, as you say, there's this issue about compliance with the United Nations and the Convention for the Protection of the Rights of People with Disability. And we are not currently compliant with that in a number of respects. And in one key respect, the United Nations Convention says that there should be no legislation which compels people to require treatment for any kind of condition against their wishes.
Thank you. George, you mentioned the criteria then on which people can be detained and treated against their will. Could you tell us what they are? And then maybe you can explain at the same time why the Act should go.
Okay, well, there is a contrast to be made between the criteria for involuntary treatment for people with a mental disorder and all other patients, ordinary medical surgical patients. So that if we take the case of a medical or surgical patient, a patient can refuse any treatment that is being offered to him or her if the treatment doesn't suit or if the person simply doesn't want to have the treatment. And this may occur even if the outcome might be quite serious and most people might see the decision as imprudent. Now, there is a way in which such people can be treated against their will, and that's under the Mental Capacity Act in our country and similar legislation elsewhere. And there are two elements to this. The first one is that the person must be incapable of making a treatment decision for themselves, due to some impairment or disturbance of the functioning of the person's mind. So that means that they're unable to understand the information given concerning the nature of the illness or why the treatment's being proposed or the expected outcomes of having the treatment or not having it. And also, whether they appreciate the relevance of this information to their predicament and whether they're able to reason with it, that is, to weigh this information in the light of what's important for that person. And the second element is, even if they lack that decision-making capacity, that the proposed treatment is in the person's best interests. And the best interest, increasingly, is giving special regard to what the person would choose according to their deep beliefs and values, their commitments and personal life goals. So that's a capacity and best interests model. Now, in contrast, people with a mental disorder, their involuntary treatment is governed by entirely different rules. They share nothing with capacity and best interests. So the approach there is what I call the disorder and risk model. That is, first, the person has a diagnosis of a mental disorder, usually vaguely, extremely vaguely defined. And second, that the person is judged to present a risk to their health or safety or to the safety of other people. Now, that's an entirely different model, as I said, disorder and risk model. Now, of course, what constitutes a mental disorder can be very difficult to define, and thus it does open possibilities for abuses of psychiatry. And the assessment of risk at the same time is subject to all sorts of inaccuracies, especially so for rare events, you know, the ones that we're most concerned to prevent, like suicide or serious violence. So comparing these rules in psychiatry and the rest of medicine points up a stark discrimination against people with mental illness, that their self-determination or autonomy is not respected in the same way as for all other patients. And there is one of the elements of discrimination. There is another. I don't know if you want me to go into that as well at this point.
Sure. Well, what? Please go. Yeah, why not?
Okay. Well, the second discrimination is refers to the risk to other people in the risk criterion. That is, that somebody may be detained if they have a mental disorder and it's necessary for the protection of other people. Now, that means that people with mental illness can be detained and treated on the basis of a supposed risk alone, solely the risk. The rest of us have to have committed an offence before we can be deprived of our liberty or be strongly suspected of having done so. In fact, I think that people with mental illness are unique in being liable to this form of what amounts to preventive detention. I would say that if people with mental illness are to be liable to this form of preventive detention based on risk alone, so should all of us. Justice would demand then, if our society was keen to detain people or act on people who seem to pose a risk to others, there would have to be some generic dangerousness legislation if it is to be non-discriminatory.
Scott, what do you make of all of this? It all sounds incredibly right, doesn't it, that there shouldn't be discrimination, unnecessary discrimination against people with mental health illness. Why is George wrong?
Well, George isn't wrong. I mean, George has done phenomenal amounts of really good work over you know, a decade or longer, articulating and researching and evidencing these arguments. And I have the utmost both kind of respect for the work and the ideas and for the principles. It's absolutely sort of right what George says, that actually we shouldn't discriminate against people and that there should be equality between people who have mental and physical health problems, absolutely. What my concern is actually the kind of, if you would like, the kind of law of unintended consequences, that actually we're about to embark on a really arcane, really esoteric legal debate, and one, to be frank, that we had and which ended up in a terrible muddle about 10 years ago, when actually what we should be concerned with is improving outcomes for patients and improving their experiences of care. And so my argument is that the law operates in the real world. The law in itself is important, and obviously legislation can shape behavior. But what's really critical, I think, is to think about what would happen if we changed the law in this way. And I think from my point of view, there are really two things that we need to think about that I think complicate George's position. One is that if mental disorder is difficult to assess and risk is difficult to assess, that's nothing as compared to trying to assess capacity, because capacity is very decision specific, capacity is very variable, and to a degree there's got to be a subjectivity in assessing capacity. And the second concern is that this is what I would kind of call almost a kind of libertarian approach, which is to say that actually everybody is free to make decisions for themselves if they have capacity to do so, even if that decision is life-ending or life-changing. And in the real world, people will come to harm. Patients will die. People will be denied help and care that they need, and there will be adverse outcomes. And that may be a price that some people think is worth paying, you know, for the sake of kind of legal and kind of utopian view of you know, all decisions being kind of equal and everybody being entitled to make decisions for themselves. The other thing about the real world that we live in is that mental health services are phenomenally under-resourced. And it's, in my view, no coincidence that we're about to embark on a review of legislation, which is quite distracting at a time when we really ought to be concentrating on how poor many of our services are and how difficult that they are for people to access. The law, when you speak to people who have been detained, they will often say that they really regret having to be detained, but had they not been detained, they might not be alive. And I think the problem is that we're looking really far downstream. We're looking at the last event in the lives of people who are really poorly and ill, when we should be looking at why they're not getting help sooner.
Thanks, Scott. George, what do you think of those arguments? Are there practical reasons why we need the Mental Health Act, given the state of services today?
Okay. I'd like to thank Scott for his very generous comments about my work. And I can see that he does agree in principle with the kind of discrimination I'm describing. So just to take each of his points in turn, I've jotted them down. The first one is about the assessment of capacity. Now, in fact, there have been a number of studies that showed an extraordinarily high inter-rate of reliability on the assessment of capacity. If you compare that with a study that Jill Pia did in the book called Decisions and Dilemmas, which I just looked at the other day, there were 40 cases there which were rated for whether a section should be employed or not by a psychiatrist and a social worker. And in 10 out of the 40, there was disagreement between them. So I think that Scott's wrong. I think the capacity is easier and more reliably assessed than whether a person has a mental disorder and whether they pose a danger to the health or safety or protection of others. The second point is Scott's making an assumption that people will suffer, that there'll be fewer people treated and more people will refuse to engage with services. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute, because the third thing is about resources. And of course, I totally agree with Scott that our resources are very slim and becoming slimmer in relationship to the number of patients that need to be treated. Now, there is a relationship between human rights and resources. And this relates to a distinction between what the human rights treaties and instruments refer to as immediate realization versus progressive realization. So there's a distinction that's made in all the UN human rights instruments, I think all of them, certainly in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and certainly in the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, between some rights that are subject to what is called immediate realization, or that is that their rights must be realized immediately in full. And these refer exactly to those civil and political rights. And then there are other rights which are subject to what's known as progressive realization. And they are exactly the economic, social and cultural rights, where resources are accepted as constraining the rate of implementation, particularly in countries that don't have many resources. In a country like ours, I think there is little excuse for not implementing those positive rights. So resources play a role in relationship to human rights, but not in relationship to these civil and political rights, liberty rights. So they must take precedence to ensure that we live in a just society, one that does not exclude or marginalize groups of people through laws that discriminate. In fact, I think the Equalities and Human Rights Commission specifically states that resource issues cannot justify restrictions on liberty rights. Now, would fewer people be treated? Well, I don't know what the answer to that is, but I suspect that the argument for more people being treated and being treated more collaboratively is perhaps stronger. So at a practical level, I would expect that mental health services would engage more effectively and earlier, as Scott points out how important early engagement is, with patients and potential patients if they were not socially marginalised, excluded and discriminated against, and if services were less enveloped in what I call the shadow of coercion, the fear that many patients have that by engaging with mental health services they will end up being coerced one way or another into treatment. And there's some evidence that when patients' voices are heard in, for example, in formulating advanced statements or joint crisis plans with mental health professionals in a collaborative way, that the need for compulsion may be reduced. Finally, on the point of the attitude of patients who have the infection, well, the largest UK study was done by Stephen Preber and colleagues, and that showed that a year after a compulsory admission, only 40% of the patients thought that compulsion was justified, even though 60% said that the treatment intervention helped. So there's a distinction to be made, I think, between what patients feel is a useful treatment and how that treatment is achieved. I would hope that the standing of patients would be improved to such an extent through a non-discriminatory health system that they would be much more likely to engage and to be partners in treatment. So perhaps it might be that patients will engage earlier and that they will be treated more effectively.
Thank you, George. Scott, there was a lot of different points there. What do you make of those arguments?
What I would say is I honestly would really like to believe that the world that George describes exists. The truth is that people generally do want help, but that it's not available. Whatever the law says, however much I kind of agree that the law should protect people's rights, that there should be these progressively realized rights, the truth is that we live in a world where, if I'm honest, rather cynically, the very people that would support and push forward George's view of changing the Act are also subtly and quietly but deliberately undermining and repealing and pulling back the state. So there's less provision for folks out there. And there's an interesting kind of quote that I remember reading somewhere about community treatment orders, which are one aspect of compulsion, which perhaps is rather questionable and may well disappear. But what it said is that it's often assumed that community treatment orders, which require people, I should say, to adhere to treatment and to attend appointments and things, that people often say, or patients often feel, that community treatment orders bind patients to services. In fact, the truth is that the Mental Health Act binds services to patients. At the moment, you can only get a bed in an NHS mental health unit if you're detained. And that's not because we enjoy sectioning people or take it lightly. That's because there aren't enough beds. You know, bed availability, bed numbers have fallen precipitously in years. And so access to services is difficult. I completely agree with George's view about how mental health services ought to operate. And I like to think that I practice in exactly the way that George describes, collaboratively. But you can't collaborate where help isn't available, where people are actually, you know, where services are rationed. And so for that reason, you know, although I'd love to agree with George, I have to say that, yes, the number of people compulsorily admitted will fall, but also people will be neglected. The right to choose is also the right to be ignored.
Thanks, Scott. George, any movement there from you?
Well, the resource issue is a critical one. I completely agree with Scott on that. I just don't think that the Mental Health Act is meant to affect resources. If it was meant to affect resources, it has failed lamentably. the number of compulsory admissions has gone up, the number of resources relatively has gone down rather drastically. Not a very good state of affairs. So I don't see the necessary connection between eliminating, stigmatizing discrimination. I mean, the Mental Health Act actually supports those negative stereotypes of people with mental illness. The two stereotypes that are particularly implicated, one is we don't need to assess a person with mental disorder's ability to make decisions for themselves. They are necessarily incompetent because they have a mental illness. They're not capable of rational thought, not capable of sound judgment. That's the first stereotype. And the second stereotype is, well, you know, dangerousness is an intrinsic part of mental illness. And so it's only proper that this particular group be singled out for preventive detention. No other group merits this kind of treatment. I mean, these are appalling, negative, discriminatory stereotypes that are reflected in the Mental Health Act. And of course, the research evidence is contrary to both of those stereotypes, that people with, even people admitted to acute psychiatric wards, we did a study at the Maudsley just a few years ago, very, very hard, as Scott says, to be admitted to a psychiatric ward. Now, you have to be very, very ill, very disturbed. But around 50% of those patients retained capacity. And similarly, looking at violence amongst people with mental illness, the violence, the rate of violence amongst people with severe mental illness, I'm talking about psychosis or affective disorder, is modestly, if at all, elevated above that in the general community. And if you exclude drugs and alcohol and antisocial personality, it's certainly not increased. And the amount of violence in the community, the proportion of convictions for serious violence by people with mental illness is just a few percent. I mean, the idea that mental illness somehow involves necessarily dangerousness is an appalling stereotype that we are somehow seduced by. And, you know, one sees it played out in so many different fora.
Would you agree with that, Scott?
I mean, I agree with a great deal of what George says, honestly, and I don't think there's that much difference between us, because I would genuinely like us to live in a world in which the law, the change in the law that he proposes, happened and was safe. I think my point of view is that if we do this before we improve services, if we do this without resources, you know, George is right. The Mental Health Act isn't meant to sort of allocate. It's not meant to make services available. But sadly, at the moment, it's the only way that some people get help. And if we have change in the law without properly funded services, and services which are scandalously poor at the moment in places, if we change the law before we improve services, we're going to see terrible things happen.
George, I think we're going to have to wrap it up now, but do you have any last words?
Yes, there is an issue around autonomy, and some people interpret autonomy as kind of individuals having absolute say over everything. Well, autonomy is much more complicated than that. I mean, there's the notion of relational autonomy, that we form our choices and decisions in relationship with other people. You know, before making a serious decision, most people will discuss it with other people. And then there are the CRPD is very, very insistent on support for decision making. And that's something I think that mental health services could learn to do much better. The idea being that by actually supporting a person, helping them to think through the kind of choices or decisions they need to make, that one actually helps them to express perhaps more clearly what their will might be, or the more clearly the kind of consequences of having the treatment or not. And the other point I would make is that I think we must pay more regard to those positive rights. And those positive rights include, for example, the right to the best available standard of care. That's in the CRPD, to education, employment, rehabilitation, adequate standard of living. These are very, very relevant to mental health care. I agree with Scott that they are very much threatened at the moment, but I don't think that improving the position of people with mental illness is going to jeopardise their care. I think it will improve it. But we must take note of these positive rights as well. And maybe they should be included in the Mental Health Act, although they're already there in the CRPD, so maybe it's not necessary. Not sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's an absolutely fascinating debate. And good luck for next Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Scott Weitsch and George Schmuckler. You can read the debate online on bmj.com, and you can attend the debate at King's College London next Wednesday, the 22nd of November. As ever, we'd be delighted to know what you think, so please send us a rapid response. We republish the best as formal letters to the editor. I'll be back with more debates in the future, so subscribe to us so you don't miss out. We're on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening.